It's interesting to see just how hard it would actually be to do this as a hoax, forging or making up a fictional gospel. A forger has to draw attention to what he's doing, or else it's of no value to him. So it's not the kind of thing that you would get with what Bart Ehrman will say, oh, this was just like a game of telephone, people telling tales to one another. You would definitely not find these kinds of undesigned coincidences in that kind of non-deliberate way. That's extremely implausible. Instead, it looks like it just really is true.
5 centuries ago, in taverns and public houses across Europe, the masses would gather for discussion and debate over the latest ideas sweeping the land. From one such meeting place, a small Cambridge inn called the White Horse, the Reformation came to the English-speaking world. Carrying on the tradition, welcome to the White Horse Inn.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the White Horse Inn. I'm Shane Rosenthal, the producer of this broadcast, and today I'm filling in for Michael Horton as the host of this particular episode. And on the line with me is Lydia McGrew. Lydia is a widely published analytic philosopher who received her PhD from Vanderbilt University, and she's written extensively on the theory of knowledge. She's also the author of a book which we'll be talking with her about on this program titled Hidden in Plain View, Undesigned Coincidences in the Gospels and Acts. Lydia McGrew, thanks for being my guest today on the White Horse Inn.
Thanks for having me, Shane.
So help us to get started out here. What is an undesigned coincidence, and where did you get the idea for this book?
Great question, Shane. I often say that an undesigned coincidence is an incidental interlocking that points to truth. And we'll see more about what that means when we get into really specific examples. Where I got the idea for the book, I guess the fairest thing to say is that I got it from my husband. Tim McGrew is an apologist and the chairman of the Department of Philosophy at Western Michigan University here in Southwest Michigan, and he's passionately interested in older books concerning apologetics and older arguments that we've forgotten. He got me very interested in this from two authors in particular, William Paley from the 18th century and John J. Blunt from the 19th century, who had written about undesigned coincidences and had popularized it in their own time. After a while, it was very popular, but then it was forgotten and just beginning to come back here in the 21st century. So after I was so interested in it, Tim and I agreed that whoever got the time to write a book about it first would do it. And I just happened to get the time to do it first.
Well, I'm personally fascinated with this kind of work. And I often think about this kind of detailed analysis of the Gospels as kind of akin to the thing you see on a show like American Pickers or Antiques Roadshow. So, you know, a person will bring in an artifact like an old desk or some kind of a painting that they either love or hate, and then they bring it to be appraised. The appraiser knows how to distinguish sort of authentic artifacts from fake reproductions. And so if it's a desk, you know, they'll pull out a drawer and they'll look at the underside and they will discuss the wood. They'll discuss the manufacturer's imprint, all to which, you know, presents the conclusion where the person is surprised by the fact that this is actually a lost treasure. On the other hand, if they're told objectively, it's a fake reproduction and it may have sentimental value to you, but it doesn't have any objective value because it was actually made to look like it was old. And I guess the thing that I think about with that analogy is that what you're doing is looking at the Gospels from this perspective of let's evaluate whether or not they are what they claim to be. They are claiming to be eyewitness accounts of what happened in the life of Jesus. And the question is, can that be demonstrated? Can we look closely at these texts to find out whether it has the appearance of eyewitness testimony or whether it's a fake reproduction, if it's fan fiction, if it's something inauthentic written much later, made to look like it was old and original at the time of Jesus?
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I think it's interesting to see just how hard it would actually be to do this deliberately as a fake or as a hoax. Man, it would take a lot of work. So it's not the kind of thing that you would get with what Bart Ehrman, the skeptical scholar, will say, for example, oh, this was just like a game of telephone, people
right.
telling tales to one another. You would definitely not find these kinds of undesigned coincidences in that kind of non-deliberate way where people are just kind of telling a story to someone and then someone else tells it to someone else and so forth, and finally it's written down.
Yeah, that's a really good point, because Bart Ehrman, he's gotten a lot of coverage. One of the things that I have done over the years on this program is I've kind of done this man on the street segment. And having been to secular universities, college students seem to be familiar with the Bart Ehrman thesis, but not the conservative explanations or responses to that argument. And so that's one of the reasons why I want to have the opportunity to talk with you. So the first undesigned coincidence that I'd like you to talk about relates to a simple comment that we find in Mark 6:39, in which we find Jesus feeding the 5,000, and then he commands all of them to sit on green grass. Why do you think the color green there is significant?
It's really interesting because Mark is the only gospel that has the word green. No other gospel bothers to mention that. It's one of those little passing details. He commanded them to sit down, and then it says they all sat down on the green grass. When you go over to John 6, which is also describing the feeding of the 5,000, in John 6:4, he just very briefly mentions, apropos of nothing, he just says, the Passover, a feast of the Jews, was near at hand. Now, unlike here in Michigan, over there around the Sea of Galilee, you don't get green grass for 8 months out of the year or something like that. But one time when you do get some green grass is shortly after those rains that you have there. And so this springtime season would be when you would have green grass. So it fits together really well, but Mark doesn't mention that the time of the Passover was near, and John does not mention the color of the grass. So they seem to be having access to what really happened in some sort of separate fashion. In fact, the feeding of the 5,000 is the only miracle found in all four Gospels. So that gives us more opportunities to kind of pick up on these little casual details to fit together.
Now, during that same event, the feeding of the 5,000, you also draw your reader's attention to something recorded in John 6:5, which reads, "Seeing that the large crowd was coming toward him, Jesus said to Philip, 'Where are we to buy bread so that these people may eat?'" What strikes you as being significant about that comment?
I think it's interesting that it mentions the name of the person to whom he spoke. It could be utterly coincidental, 1 out of 12 chance he picked some disciple at random. But if the story were faked, you might have thought that the author would have chosen a more prominent disciple rather than Philip. There's something just a little bit random. It's not that Philip is utterly obscure, but just that there's no particular reason to mention him here. For example, unlike Judas, he is not the treasurer of the group. Unlike Peter, James, and John, he's not part of the closest inner circle to Jesus. So if you go over to Luke 9:10, we have a fact mentioned which is not mentioned in John, I might just add. In fact, it's only mentioned in Luke, which is that this event took place in a deserted area near the town of Bethsaida. Okay, so what? Well, John doesn't mention the location at all, but if you go to a completely different passage in the Gospel of John, John 1:43-44, right at the beginning of Jesus' ministry when he's kind of gathering up disciples here and there, it mentions Philip, and it says he was from the town of Bethsaida. Now, I think Jesus was pulling his disciples' chain a little bit. In fact, John kind of says this, that he knew what he would do. He doesn't ask them where they can buy bread because he really wants them to buy bread. But when he chooses which disciple to tease, as it were, I think he turns to Philip to say, "Philip, you're from nearby here. Where can we buy bread that all of these may eat?" And so he picks Philip because he knows Philip is local to the area. And it all fits together in an extremely mentally satisfying way, but it's so casual that no one would do that deliberately. You can't imagine John saying, "Oh, I think I'm going to fake my readers out in picking up this story from the other Gospels, but I want to make it even more realistic, so I'll just put this little casual mention of Philip. Then I won't mention Bethsaida at all, and then in a totally different
right.
passage, I'll mention that Philip was from Bethsaida, and maybe 2,000 years from now, someone will notice that and say, 'Wow, it must be true.'" That's extremely, extremely implausible. Instead, it looks like it just really is true.
Yeah, and especially when you put all these coincidences together is when it really sort of begins to hit you. This does not look like artifice.
Not at all, particularly because they're so casual, which
right.
is something I mention a lot in the book, and it's something I find that skeptics find it difficult to understand. Skeptics don't understand the evidential value of casualness. A forger or a faker has to draw attention to what he's doing, or else it's of no value to him. If
right.
he just mentions casually that Jesus spoke to Philip, what value is that to him? It's likely that no one will even notice it. So that's another part of what gives this cumulative case its force.
I was in my readings of Josephus. I ran across this scene that's very interesting, in which Josephus records that the town Bethsaida was actually renamed Julius around 30 AD. It was built up and then renamed. So right around this time, this would be when Jesus, you know, his ministry was probably from 28 to 30. So when they are here at Bethsaida, they're calling it the right name. And it's interesting, if you look at Josephus, he actually has about 16 references to the town named Julius. And then only once does he mention the older name, and that in the account of the name change. And he's writing in the 70s or the 90s. So it's interesting that all four Gospels use the right name without even referring to this name change, which may be an indication that it's certainly the right thing that you would expect for the authors who were writing at that time about that location the way it was then.
I agree, because particularly this author, John, he's very conversant with the topography of Galilee and with specific places in Jerusalem in the early first century prior to the destruction of Jerusalem. And so what you're talking about there shows that acquaintance of that author with that name. He also mentions Cana of Galilee. He mentions, for example, that they went down from Cana to Capernaum. That's in John.
Right.
Why down? Well, because it's toward the sea side, so you would be going down the hills and so forth. So he's always right in these things. He kind of steps through it in this effortless way, like a person who is a native of that time and that place. And that's what you're bringing up.
Richard Bauckham has this great line. In fact, he said it when we interviewed him on this program, that when it comes to a witness, you know, in a court of law, you can't actually go back in time to see whether or not what they're telling you is true. But what you can do is establish whether a witness is generally credible by the things that you can test. And that has always stuck with me, especially when looking at John. As you go through John again and again and again, he is giving you very detailed and accurate first century information. In fact, I agree with John A.T. Robinson, who said, when you look at John's gospel, his chronology is actually the most detailed, and it's the best skeleton that you can place the other gospels, which sort of present the material more topically.
I completely agree. Another good thing that Bauckham has said about John is that in John, we always know exactly where Jesus is. It's this fascinating thing. He doesn't just say Jesus was in Jerusalem. He says Jesus was in Jerusalem in the Porch of Solomon, or he was at the Pool of Bethesda, which is near the Sheep Gate.
With five porticos.
He's always telling you exactly where Jesus is. And I think that point about trusting a witness is so important, because if we look at John and we look at all of these factual things scattered throughout, that should give us a sense that John is truthful. So in that indirect way, our discoveries in archaeology, undesigned coincidences in other passages and so forth, the point is this confirms John's historical intention and his intention to present himself to his readers as historical, which is often questioned by scholarship. I sometimes say John is treated as the problem child of the New Testament or the problem child of the Gospels. That should absolutely not be the case. He should instead be treated as sort of the star pupil, because he's so excellent in all of these ways.
Yeah, a lot of New Testament scholars, especially on the liberal wing, like to describe John as he's more than any of the evangelists. He is doing theology, not history. And my own conclusion, especially after engaging with a lot of really recent conservative scholarship and also some liberal scholarship, which is coming to conservative conclusions. I mean, I just mentioned Richard Bauckham. He's a mainline guy, liberal in some areas, but he has come to very conservative conclusions, particularly when he says that John is an actual eyewitness presenting truthful, reliable information. What John actually ends up doing is he presents eyewitness history that has theological implications.
That's very well put. I agree. I do find it interesting that sometimes even people who are considered a little more on the conservative spectrum, I don't know where one would exactly put N.T. Wright, but Wright has been quoted as saying, "I feel about John the way I feel about my wife. I love her, but I would never claim to understand her." This is often used to imply that John is less historical than
right.
the Synoptics, and it gets quoted around. And I really disagree with that implication. I don't think we should think of it that way. We should definitely think of it as very historically grounded. And I think listeners will be interested when they see that even in our short sample that we have here, several more of the coincidences actually concern John. It's hard to get around that. In fact, he has more coincidences for his unique material than any other gospel does. The more he tells us, the more we have a chance to confirm. And that's kind of cool.
All right. Now let's get to another one of these undesigned coincidences. You say in Mark 15:43, there's a passing comment to the effect that Joseph of Arimathea took courage when he asked for the body of Jesus. You then point out that this unexplained comment actually makes sense in the light of what John records in his gospel.
Yeah, that's right. And you might think, well, yeah, Jesus had just been crucified. Of course, Joseph of Arimathea would have been afraid, but not necessarily to approach Pilate. The Romans liked to be helpful to Jewish sensibilities. They might crucify your relative, but they would allow you to bury your relative. So for Joseph to go to Pilate didn't necessarily take any particular courage, and yet Mark says he gathered up his courage and went to Pilate and asked for the body of Jesus. Why is that? Well, when you go to John 19:38, you find him saying of Joseph of Arimathea, he was a disciple of Jesus, but secretly for fear of the Jews. And I think what this gives us reason to believe is that Joseph of Arimathea became part of the Christian community, and he made it known who he had been and what his motives were and what his thoughts were. And so Mark has access to that. He knows that Joseph was at this point somewhat afraid, and so he mentions indirectly he had been needing to take up his courage. But then John explicitly states he had been a disciple, but secretly for fear of the Jews. So they both seem independently to come at this fact that Joseph was a somewhat timid person, or previously had been, but was now coming forward.
Another coincidence you point out relates to the fact that Matthew lists the disciples in pairs of two.
Yeah, that's a kind of an interesting one. Matthew inserts the word "and" in these strategic places, which is kind of cool to see. He'll say Peter and Andrew, James and John, but he'll also say James, the son of Alphaeus, and Thaddeus. So it's not only the brothers that he's pairing up. He pairs up all of the disciples like this, and he doesn't put ands in between them. It's not just one long list of ands. You know, it's not Philip and Bartholomew and Thomas and Matthew and so forth. He tends to pair them up like this in Matthew 10, 2 through 4. All three of the synoptic gospels, as they're called, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, have these lists. But in his list, he has this little pairing thing going on, which is kind of interesting. If you go over to Mark 6:7, that's a different passage. When Mark gives the list, he doesn't pair them up in any special way. But when he talks about Jesus sending out the disciples, sometimes called the commissioning of the 12, he says he sent them out by twos. So he sent them out by pairs. So Matthew seems, it seems plausible to conjecture, to be thinking of this. He's thinking of them in pairs. He thinks of them in twos because Jesus thought of them in twos. Jesus thought that when they went out, they should have a buddy with them. It was like what we would call a buddy system.
Right. Yeah, that's his experience. And so it's just second nature to record them that way.
That's right.
Talk to our listeners about the foot washing scene that's recorded in John 13 and the background to it that you say Luke ends up providing for us in his account of the Last Supper.
That's so interesting because John, of course, is the only gospel that tells us that Jesus washed the disciples' feet. And you might ask yourself, I wonder why Jesus did that just then. And it could just be random in a sense. It could just be Jesus is going to die and he wants to give them this illustration of love. But it would be interesting if we had a more specific reason. When you go to Luke 22, you find it mentioning that they were bickering about who was going to be the greatest in the kingdom of heaven on that very night. And Jesus rebukes them. He says the kings of the Gentiles exercise lordship over them. and those who are great among them are called their benefactors. But it shall not be so among you, but the greatest shall be as the youngest, and the leader as the servant of all. We hear so many sermons about servant leadership that we are used to thinking of Jesus as a very servant kind of guy. But actually, there aren't a lot of instances in the Gospels where Jesus actually does something servant-like for his disciples. But one very striking one is, of course, the foot washing, because it says he took off his outer garment and he girded himself as a servant and he washed their feet. Now, that seems to be what Jesus' words in Luke, "I am among you as the one who serves," are referring to. But Luke doesn't tell about the foot washing. Maybe he didn't even know about it. He's apparently putting it in there because he has reason to believe that Jesus said this. So it's a very nice little coincidence. And you notice there's a double one there. Why does Jesus wash the disciples' feet that night? Because they had been bickering, not mentioned in John. Why does Jesus say, "I am among you as the one who serves," in Luke? Because of the foot washing, not mentioned in Luke. So you have this double whammy, as it were, a twofer that links that together, links those two Gospels together
right.
at that point.
Yeah, that's really, really interesting, the way those two intersect. They fit like hand in glove.
They do, or two jigsaw puzzle pieces. The front
yeah.
of my book cover
jigsaw pieces,
jigsaw
yeah,
puzzle.
Right, yeah. So Richard Bauckham, again, to bring up this Cambridge scholar, I don't think he's at Cambridge any longer, but he makes a fascinating argument for the reliability of John's gospel by pointing out that this particular scene here recorded, again, like you said, exclusively by John in his gospel, the foot washing scene in John 13, that scene in which a superior washes the feet of his inferiors and instructs them to do likewise is so unusual that it's actually easy to trace historical references to it. So you find, for example, Tertullian and Origen and Augustine mentioning this as a Christian practice. It's, you know, part of the aspect of hospitality. But actually, what Bauckham points out is that the earliest reference to this practice outside of John is actually from 63 A.D., and it's in Paul's first letter to Timothy. So in 1 Timothy 5:9, he refers to widows who have shown hospitality and have washed the feet of the saints. So in other words, to make a long story short, by 63 A.D., foot washing appears not to merely be a menial task for the lowest slave, which is the way it was thought of throughout the ancient world, but it's actually become a widespread Christian practice of hospitality. So what could explain that? It just so happens that John gives us an explanation that really fits what we know from history. And his explanation is that Jesus actually took his disciples through this enacted parable where he, as the superior, washed the disciples' feet and instructed them to do likewise.
That's especially striking because probably the Gospel of John had not yet been written by the time that Paul's letter to Timothy had been written. So that's interesting because it certainly doesn't look like Paul is getting that from the Gospel of John.
Yeah, most people put the Gospel of John, they date it around, you know, in the 90s. I'm one of these conservative crazies who thinks it's pre-70 AD. But whatever your view, the practice that we find recorded as assumed, again, a light touch, that's an assumption of a practice that's widespread. It doesn't look like it's informed by the Gospel of John because it hasn't been written. What it's informed by is the teaching of Jesus that's been spreading throughout the church, which John later accurately records.
That's correct. And as you're pointing out, it would have had to be going on for a while, or Paul couldn't mention it in this casual fashion.
Right.
Again, there's another type of way that casualness is evidentially relevant. Paul mentions this is something that's obviously well known to his audience. And these women would have been the mistresses of the house. And I think that's part of the point that Bauckham is making. You wouldn't have the mistress of the house washing your feet. If they didn't happen to have a slave, then you would wash your own feet. They might bring you water or something to do it, but the lady of the house would not get down and do it for you.
Right, but the fact that a superior would do this to an inferior is very, very unusual in recorded history. So it's a Christian practice that develops out of Jesus' teaching.
That's right. That's right.
So you say that Jesus' words to Pilate, "If my kingdom were of this world, my servants would have been fighting." You say that that stands in tension to a scene recorded earlier in that same chapter, John 18, in which Peter does actually take up the sword and ends up maiming a servant of the high priest by the name of Malchus. Why do you think that's significant?
I think that it would have been rather cheeky of Jesus to have brought up that possibility if they could have verified that one of his servants actually had fought. Jesus says to Pilate, my kingdom is not of this world. And then he tries to give evidence for that. He says, if my kingdom is of this world, my servants would be fighting that I would not be delivered unto the Jews. But in John 18:10, that has actually happened. Peter has cut off somebody's ear. So you would think Jesus would not bring this up. He does not want to draw attention to this because Pilate would just say, actually, they're complaining to me that one of your servants cut off the ear of somebody when they were trying to arrest you last night. So this is exactly what you're saying is not going on. What is the deal? Why are you bringing this up? That's not explained in John. If you go over to the arrest scene in Luke 22, when they do arrest Jesus, we see the reason. Because there it says that Jesus actually performed a miracle. He said first, Peter, put up your sword. So he stops the fighting, and then he takes the ear and he literally heals it. So Jesus knows that he's done this. So he can afford to make that comment to Pilate, because nobody's going to bring forward, well, yes, one of the servants of Jesus, one of his followers did fight, but then Jesus stopped him, and then Jesus healed the guy's ear. That would just give more evidence of Jesus' goodwill, of his desire not to lead an armed revolution, of his mercy to his enemies, and so forth, which would not be the narrative that they would be wanting to bring forward. So that's why he is able to say this to Pilate with such confidence in John 18:36.
I also find it interesting that in the Synoptic Gospels, Peter's name is completely left out of that scene in which he draws the sword and severs the guy's ear. So if you go to Matthew 26:51, it says, one of those who were with Jesus struck the ear. Or Mark 14:47, one of those who stood by drew his sword. And that's really interesting because a lot of New Testament scholars say that Mark's gospel is Peter's gospel. Mark is Peter's traveling associate. So a New Testament scholar by the name of Gerd Thiessen writes about this and he says, quote, it seems to me that the motive for this anonymity is not hard to guess. The one who draws his sword commits no minor offense when he cuts off someone's ear. In Jerusalem, there was a reason to draw a cloak of anonymity over the followers of Jesus who had endangered themselves by their actions. In other words, when this is written, the gospel writers are still putting this cloak of anonymity over Peter because they're protecting him from additional charges that can be assigned to him for longer jail time.
It's a possibility. I'm not going to discount it as a possibility. I will say, though, that Peter seems to have had a pretty big target on himself already, as we can definitely see in Acts, and it's almost possible that he may have had to go away for a while. John Wem has suggested possibly that when it says he went away to another place, he may have gone as far as Rome, but it's not clear to me that they actually would have put Peter in significantly greater danger by recording that fact about him, especially if Peter was already in Rome by the time that these were written down. It's just very hard to tell. Peter may also have been a little bit embarrassed himself. He may have felt that Jesus rebuked him for putting up his sword, and he's a little confused as to why Jesus did that after asking them if they had swords earlier. And so he just doesn't want to get into all of it, so he doesn't mention it. So we don't even know all the reasons. And that's also very realistic about these accounts that we don't always know all the reasons.
Another question you ask related to this scene here with Malchus is how John appears to have inside information, particularly with regard to that servant's name. Later in that chapter, John, in his narration, points out that one of the guards who questioned Peter was actually a relative of this same Malchus. How are we to account for that kind of detailed inside information? How does John know the name of this high priest's servant and also his relative? How does he have that inside information?
Exactly. And the appearance there, again, is of this wonderful casualness and randomness. I was reading the account of Jesus' trial before Annas yesterday with my teenage daughter, and I read, they took him to Annas, who was the father-in-law of Caiaphas, who was high priest that year. And she turned to me and she said, that's really random. And I kind of take her point, just mentioning, you know, this guy was the father-in-law of Caiaphas. And I think we get that same feeling here. And the servant's name was Malchus. Completely pointless, unnecessary detail. Or later, when someone is questioning Peter, he was the relative of the one whose ear Peter had cut off. But how would anyone know that? We have no reason to believe any of these people became Christians later on. Well, if you go to that same chapter, right in between those two verses, to verses 15 to 16, you find it mentioned that the, quote, other disciple, whose name is not given at this point, was known to the high priest. He had a connection. In fact, one theory that's been put forward is that possibly the Zebedee family might have supplied dried fish to the high priest's household. That, of course, is conjectural. But he seems to have known, in a sense, the servants, because he knows the servant girl, and he comes and says, oh, it's okay, he's my friend, you can let him in, and gets Peter access. So he knows that servant group, who's related to whom, and that's why he's able to just mention these little extra details as it goes through. Oh, yeah, and that guy's name was Malchus. This, again, fits with that oral history quality that the Gospel of John has. Again, if you interview someone for an oral history project, you'll find them doing this. They'll say, and my best friend's name at that time, his name was Joe. They'll mention these little facts. People love to do that. And I think that's what John was doing when he was telling this story.
There was a liberal scholar by the name of C.H. Dodd, very liberal scholar of the last century. But he wrote about that verse where it says, Simon Peter followed Jesus, and so did another disciple who was known to the high priest. And he focused on that word known, and he said it implies something more than mere acquaintance. It means that the person was a member of the high priest's circle, possibly a kinsman, and himself of priestly birth, one who stands in intimate relations with the governing high priestly family. Calvin actually points this out, too. He thought that that disciple who was known to the high priest, it may not be as easy to fit that with John the Apostle. Calvin says, you know, what acquaintance with the high priest can a simple fisherman from Galilee have? Now, you mentioned that he could have been the person who sold him fish. So that is one of the things that comes up in the commentaries. But the challenge would be, this is a late night interrogation. And then secondly, this particular disciple who is with Peter, who was with them in the garden, has no fear to enter into the courtyard of the high priest with Jesus. And then later, Peter comes to the gate. He is not allowed in. In fact, this is another interesting touch point with the other Gospels, because they just present Peter in the courtyard of the high priest, but they don't explain how he received access. But this other disciple, who's known to the high priest, goes to the gate, like you mentioned. That, to me, doesn't sound like a fisherman's relationship with the high priest. I agree with Dodd and other scholars like him who say this is someone who's in the priestly circle, who is also a disciple like Joseph of Arimathea secretly, which is why his name is not mentioned in the text. And that's why he has the authority to let Peter in.
So do you take that other disciple then not to be the author of the gospel?
I actually do take it to be the author of the gospel. I am with Richard Bauckham and others who say that John the Apostle is not the author of the Gospel of John, but it's this other John who was an eyewitness and who is secretly a disciple, which is why the book ends with this sort of anonymity. Nowhere in the Gospel of John do you find it declared to be written by John the Apostle. Whichever side you fall on that debate, it's conjecture either way. And I think my own reading of the gospel is that the best explanation for the anonymity that we find in the Gospel of John is that it's written by an eyewitness who is not the Apostle John, but was well known to the high priestly family.
That's interesting. I do consider it to be the son of Zebedee, but we can certainly agree to disagree on that.
Right.
I have read Bauckham's book recently. In fact, I did a review in which I say some things I agree with, some things I disagree with, and so forth. And I was interested by his argument, but unconvinced that it was different John, who is not the son of Zebedee. But, of course, the more important point would be the eyewitness nature of the testimony for the reliability of the Gospels, and that's in some ways the most important point.
So if we take a step back and look at this from the perspective of a radical liberal hypothesis, seeing John's Gospel not as eyewitness material, but rather as a kind of fan fiction written much later, we could ask the question, why would the author take the time to write and invent the name of an insignificant character like Malchus, but not
exactly,
but not record his own name? In other words, whatever your view of the authorship of John's Gospel, it is ambiguous because the author of John's Gospel is just listed as the beloved disciple. You have to sort of put the data together and make the best conclusion. in all the most famous fan fiction gospels, the Gnostic gospels, you are gaining credibility by associating the material with one of the famous disciples, like the Gospel of Mary Magdalene, the Gospel of Thomas, the Gospel of Peter. You're associating, here's new secret information that Jesus gave to Peter and Jesus gave to Mary Magdalene. Turns out when you read those Gospels, they don't really sound Jewish at all. They sound Greek, and they go into Gnostic theology. I guess the biggest question is why, if you're making up this Gospel, do you make up the name Malchus, but you don't make up your own identity as an authoritative apostle?
I think that's an excellent point, because it really would be far more relevant to the purpose of someone forging or making up a fictional gospel to, in some way, attribute it very strongly to himself by a high-profile name. Now, one sees these theories that Malchus in one language means king or something, and so you'll see these theories about the possible symbolic meaning of that kind of thing. And I really think that a very bad habit of New Testament scholarship, in some ways across the ideological spectrum, is the replacement of complex theories for simple theories. By far the simplest theory is that he said he was Malchus because he was Malchus, not because of some heavy symbological meaning that
right.
he was trying to put in there.
So, Lydia, after reading your book, I started to think about other possible undesigned coincidences, which I then started to correspond with you about. And one of them you actually blogged about. It's the one that was inspired by something I read in Richard Bauckham's book, The Testimony of the Beloved Disciple. And he observed that in Luke and Acts in particular, we frequently find this language of those who were eyewitnesses from the beginning. So that's there in Luke's prologue, and that's also repeated in Acts 1 when the 11 are finding a replacement for Judas. But when we get to John chapter 15, that's actually rooted in something Jesus specifically taught. He says, quote, "You also will bear witness because you have been with me from the beginning."
Yeah, that's such a fascinating connection, and I liked it when you sent it to me. Now, the Acts 1 section, where they're selecting a replacement for Judas, comes in between Jesus saying shortly before he ascended into heaven and Pentecost in Acts 2. Right in between there, they're selecting the replacement for Judas. So this would have been fresh in their minds. Again, if we take John and we take Luke seriously as reporters, we take this to be reportage, they're thinking, okay, we'd like to select a replacement. What kind of replacement do we want? Oh, yeah, he said that it would be those because we had been with him from the beginning. So let's pick somebody who's been all the way from the baptism of John. And so those are the criteria that they use for choosing. And then they cast lots, and Matthias is chosen from among the candidates. So it's a very realistic portrait of their having these words of Jesus in their minds and then using this as requirements.
Well, folks, you've been hearing from Lydia McGrew, author of Hidden in Plain View, Undesigned Coincidences in the Gospels and in Acts. We didn't even get to any of the undesigned coincidences that you record between the book of Acts and the epistles of Paul. Give our listeners a quick reason why that's an important endeavor.
It's extremely important because Acts bridges between the Gospels and the development of the church in the early church. And we see from these undesigned coincidences that the author was a close companion of Paul and a truthful and a reliable person. And bonus, he was the author of the Gospel of Luke. So it's a wonderful connection between the Gospels and the rest of our knowledge.
Very, very helpful. For more information about Lydia McGrew and her work, check out her website at lydiamcgrew.com. Lydia, thank you so much for helping us to understand the historical reliability and the eyewitness character of the four Gospels.
Thanks for having me, Shane.
The White Horse Inn is a listener-supported broadcast. For more information about this program, visit us online at whitehorseinn.org. If you sign up as an innkeeper, architect, or reformer, not only will you get a complimentary subscription to our magazine, Modern Reformation, but you'll also get longer editions of every White Horse Inn broadcast. To find out how to join one of these support programs, click on the support tab of our website, whitehorseinn.org. You can also give us a call at 1-800-890-7556. That's 1-800-890-7556. We'll see you next time at the White Horse Inn.